Here's your blood money, you eel, Kaladin said, pushing the light toward them. Rock, can you get him? Large hands took Teft, surprisingly gentle with their touch. He was crying. Kalek. Where's your coat, Teft? Kaladin asked from the darkness.
I sold it,
Teft admitted, squeezing his eyes shut against the shame spren that drifted down around him in the shape of flower petals.
I sold my own storming coat.
Kaladin fell silent, and Teft let Rock carry him from the den. Halfway back, he finally managed to scrounge up enough dignity to complain about Rock's breath and make them let him walk on his own feet, with a little support under the arms. Teft envied better men than he. They didn't have the itch, the one that went so deep that it stung his soul. It was persistent, always with him, and couldn't ever be scratched, despite how hard he tried. Kaladin and Rock set him up in one of the barrack rooms, private, wrapped in blankets and with a bowl of Rock's stew in his hands. Teft made the proper noises, the ones they expected. Apologies, promises he would tell them if he was feeling the need again. Promises that he'd let them help him, though he couldn't eat the stew, not yet. It would be another day before he could keep anything down. Storms, but they were good men. Better friends than he deserved. They were all growing into something grand, while Teft just stayed on the ground looking up. They left him to get some rest. He stared at the stew, smelling the familiar scent, not daring to eat it. He'd go back to work before the day was out, training bridgemen from the other crews. He could function. He could go for days pretending that he was normal. Storms he'd balanced everything in Sadius's army for years before taking one step too far, missing duty one too many times and landing himself in the bridge crews as punishment. Those months running bridges had been the only time in his adult life when he hadn't been dominated by the Moss. But even back then, when he'd been able to afford a little alcohol, he'd known that eventually he'd find his way back. The liquor wasn't ever enough. Even as he braced himself to go to work for the day, one nagging thought overshadowed his mind. A shameful thought. I'm not going to get any more Moss for a while, am I? That sinister knowledge hurt him more than anything. He was going to have to go a few excruciating days feeling like half a man. Days when he couldn't feel anything but his own self-loathing. Days living with the shame, the memories, the glances of other bridgemen. Days without any storming help whatsoever. That terrified him. 42. Consequences. Sephandrius, bearer of the first gem, you must know better than to approach us by relying upon presumption of past relationship. Inside the increasingly familiar vision, Dalinar carefully knocked an arrow, then released, sending a black-fletched missile into the back of the wild man. The man's screech was lost in the cacophony of battle. Ahead, men fought frantically as they were pushed backward toward the edge of a cliff. Dalinar methodically knocked a second arrow, then loosed. This arrow hit as well, lodging in a man's shoulder. The man dropped his axe mid-swing, causing him to miss the young, dark-skinned youth lying on the ground. The boy was barely into his teens. The awkwardness hadn't left him yet, and he had limbs that seemed too long, a face that was too round, too childlike. Dalinar might have let him run messages, but not hold a spear. The lad's age hadn't prevented him from being named Prime Akasix Yonagon I, ruler of Aesir, emperor of Greater Makabak. Dalinar had perched on some rocks, bow in hand. While he didn't intend to repeat his mistake of letting Queen Fen manage all on her own in a vision, he also didn't want Yonagon to slip through it without challenge or stress. There was a reason that the Almighty had often put Dalinar in danger in these visions. He'd needed a visceral understanding of what was at stake. He felled another enemy who got close to the boy. The shots weren't difficult from his vantage near the fight. He had some training with the bow, though his archery in recent years had been with so-called shard bows, Fabrial bows crafted with such a heavy draw weight that only a man in shard plate could use them. It was strange experiencing this battle for the third time. Though each repetition played out slightly differently, there were certain familiar details. The sense of smoke and moldy, inhuman blood. The way that man below fell after losing an arm, screaming the same half-prayer, half-condemnation of the Almighty. With Dalinar's bowmanship, the band of defenders lasted against the enemy until that radiant climbed up over the edge of the cliff, glowing in shardplate. Emperor Yanagon sat down as the other soldiers rallied around the radiant and pushed the enemy backward. Dalinar lowered his bow, reading the terror in the youth's trembling figure. Other men spoke of getting the shakes when a fight was over, the horror of it catching up with them. The Emperor finally stumbled to his feet, using the spear like a staff. He didn't notice Dalinar, didn't even question why some of the bodies around him had arrows in them. This boy was no soldier, though Dalinar hadn't expected him to be one. From his experience, Azish generals were too pragmatic to want the throne. It involved too much pandering to bureaucrats and, apparently, dictating essays. The youth started down a path away from the cliff, and Dalinar followed. Ahare Etiam. The people who lived through this had thought it the end of the world. Surely they'd assumed they'd soon return to the tranquiline halls. How would they respond to the information that, after 4 millennia, mankind still hadn't been allowed back into heaven? The boy stopped at the bottom of the twisting path which led into the valley between rock formations. He watched wounded men limp by, supported by friends. Moans and shouts rose in the air. Dalinar intended to step up and start explaining about these visions, but the boy strode out to walk beside some wounded men, chatting with them. Dalinar followed, curious, catching fragments of the conversation. What happened here? Who are you? Why were you fighting? The men didn't have many answers. They were wounded, exhausted, trailed by pain spren. They did find their way to a larger group, though, in the direction Yasna had gone during Dalinar's previous visit to this vision. The crowd had gathered around a man standing on a large boulder. Tall and confident, the man was in his 30s, and he wore white and blue. He had an Alethi feel to him, except not quite. His skin was a shade darker, and something was faintly off about his features. Yet there was something familiar about the man. "You must spread the word," the man proclaimed. "We have won. At long last, the Voidbringers are defeated. This is not my victory, or that of the other heralds. It is your victory. You have done this." Some of the people shouted in triumph. Too many others stood silent, staring with dead eyes. "I will lead the charge for the Tranquiline Halls," the man shouted. "You will not see me again, but think not on that now. You have won your peace. Revel in it. Rebuild. Go now. Help your fellows. Carry with you the light of your herald king's words. We are victorious, at long last, over evil." Another round of shouts, more energetic this time. Storms, Dalinar thought, feeling a chill. This was Ysereza Ilin himself, herald of kings, the greatest among them. Wait, did the king have dark eyes? The group broke up, but the young emperor remained, staring at the place where the herald had stood. Finally he whispered, "O Ysir, king of the heralds." "Yes," Dalinar said, stepping up beside him. "That was him, Your Excellency. My niece visited this vision earlier, and she wrote that she thought she'd spotted him." Yanagon grabbed Dalinar by the arm.
"What did you say? You know me?"
"You are Yanagon of Azir," Dalinar said. He nodded his head in a semblance of a bow. "I am Dalinar Kholin, and I apologize that our meeting must take place under such irregular circumstances." The youth's eyes widened.
"I see Ysir himself first, and now my enemy."
"I am not your enemy," Dalinar sighed. And this is no mere dream, Your Excellency.
I know it's not a dream, Yanagon said. As I am a prince raised to the throne miraculously, the heralds may choose to speak through me.
He looked about.
This day we are living through. It is the day of glory.
Ahari Etion, Dalinar said. Yes.
Why did they place you here? What does it mean?
They didn't place me here, Dalinar said. Your Excellency, I instigated this vision, and I brought you into it. Skeptical, the boy folded his arms. He wore the leather skirt provided by the vision. He'd left his bronze-tipped spear leaning against a rock nearby. Have you been told, Dalinar asked, that I am considered mad?
There are rumors.
Well, this was my madness, Dalinar said. I suffered visions during the storms. Come, see. He led Yonagon to a better view of the large field of the dead which spread out from the mouth of the canyon. Yonagon followed, then his face grew ashen at the sight. Finally, he strode down onto the larger battlefield, moving among the corpses, moans, and curses. Dalinar walked beside him. So many dead eyes, so many faces twisted in pain, light-eyed and dark, pale skin like the Shin and some horn-eaters, dark skin like the Makabaki, many that could have been Alethi, Vaden, or Herdazian. There were other things, of course. The giant broken stone figures, parshmen wearing war form with chitin armor and orange blood. One spot they passed had a whole heap of strange kremlings, burned and smoking. Who would have taken the time to pile up 1,000 little crustaceans?
We fought together, Yanagon said.
How else could we have resisted, Dalinar said. To fight the desolation alone would be madness. Yanagon eyed him.
You wanted to talk to me without the viziers. You wanted me alone. And you can just... You just show me whatever will strengthen your argument.
If you accept that I have the power to show you these visions, Dalinar said, would that not in itself imply that you should listen to me?
The Alethi are dangerous. Do you know what happened the last time the Alethi were in Aesir?
The Sunmaker's rule was a long time ago.
The viziers have talked about this, Yanagon said. They told me all about it. It started the same way back then, with the warlord uniting the Alethi tribes.
Tribes? Dalinar said. You'd compare us to the nomads that roamed Tubela? Alethkar is one of the most cultured kingdoms on Roshar.
Your code of law is barely 30 years old.
Your Excellency, Dalinar said, taking a deep breath, I doubt this line of conversation will be relevant. Look around us. Look and see what the desolation will bring. He swept his hand across the awful view, and Yanagon's temper cooled. It was impossible to feel anything but sorrow when confronted by so much death. Eventually, Yanagon turned and started back the way they'd come. Dalinar joined him, hands clasped behind.
They say, Yanagon whispered, that when the Sunmaker rode out of the passes and into Aesir, he had one unexpected problem. He conquered my people too quickly, and didn't know what to do with all of his captives. He couldn't leave a fighting population behind him in the towns. There were thousands upon thousands of men he needed to murder. Sometimes he'd simply assign the work to his soldiers. Every man was to kill 30 captives, like a child who had to find an armload of firewood before being allowed to play. In other places, the Sunmaker declared something arbitrary, say that every man with hair beyond a certain length was to be slaughtered. Before he was struck down with disease by the heralds, he murdered 10% of the population of Aesir. They say Zophix was filled with the bones, blown by high storms into piles as tall as the buildings.
I am not my ancestor, Dalinar said softly.
You revere him? The Alethi all but worship Sadies. You carry his storming shard blade.
I gave that away.
They stopped at the edge of the battlefield. The Emperor had grit, but didn't know how to carry himself. He walked with shoulders slumped, and his hands kept reaching for pockets his antiquated clothing didn't have. He was of low birth, though in Aesir they didn't properly revere eye color. Navani had once told him it was because there weren't enough people in Aesir with light eyes. The Sunmaker himself had used this to justify conquering them.
I am not my ancestor, Dalinar repeated. But I do share much with him. A youth of brutality, a lifetime spent at war. I have one advantage he did not.
Which is?
Dalinar met the young man's eyes.
I've lived long enough to see the consequences of what I've done.
Yanagon nodded slowly.
Yeah,
a voice piped up.
You're old.
Dalinar turned, frowning. But it sounded like a young girl. Why would there be a girl on the battlefield?
I didn't expect you to be so old,
the girl said. She sat perched cross-legged on a large boulder nearby.
And you're not really that black. They called you Blackthorn, but you're really more like Dark Tan Thorn. Gox is more black than you are, and even he's pretty brownish.
The young Emperor, remarkably, burst into an enormous grin.
Lift! You're back!
He started climbing up the boulder, heedless of decorum.
Not quite back, she said. Got sidetracked. But I'm close now.
What happened in Yeddah?
Yanagon said, eager.
You barely gave me any kind of explanation.
Those people lie about their food.
She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar as the young Emperor slipped down the boulder, then tried to climb up another side.
This is not possible, the Stormfather said in Dalinar's mind. How did she come here?
You didn't bring her in, Dalinar said softly.
No, this is not possible. How?
Yanagon finally attained the top of the boulder and gave the younger girl a hug. She had long dark hair, pale white eyes, and tan skin. Though she likely wasn't a Lethi, the face was too round. Reshi, perhaps?
He's trying to convince me I should trust him,
Yanagon said, pointing at Dalinar.
Don't, she said. He's got too nice a butt.
Dalinar cleared his throat.
What?
Your butt is too nice. Old guys shouldn't have tight butts. It means you spend way too much time swinging a sword or punching people. You should have an old, flabby butt. Then I'd trust you.
She has a thing about butts, Yanagon said.
No, I don't, the girl said, rolling her eyes. If someone thinks I'm strange for talking about butts, it's usually because they're jealous, because I'm the only one without something rammed up mine.
She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar, then took the Emperor by the arm.
Let's go.
But,
Dalinar said, raising his hand.
See? You're learning,
she grinned at him. Then she and the Emperor vanished. The Stormfather rumbled in frustration.
That woman! This is a creation specifically meant to defy my will.
Woman? Dalinar asked, shaking his head.
That child is tainted by the Night Watcher.
Technically, so am I.
This is different. This is unnatural. She goes too far.
The Stormfather rumbled his discontent, refusing to speak to Dalinar further. He seemed genuinely upset. In fact, Dalinar was forced to sit and wait until the vision finished. He spent the time staring out over that field of the dead, haunted equally by the future and the past.
43. Spearmen. You have spoken to one who cannot respond. We, instead, will take your communication to us, though we know not how you located us upon this world. Moash picked at the mush that Febrith called a stew. It tasted like creme. He stared at the flame spren in their large cook fire, trying to warm himself as Febrith
a Thalen man with striking horn-eater red hair, argued with Graves. The fire's smoke curled into the air, and the light would be visible for miles across the Frostlands. Graves didn't care. He figured that if the Everstorm hadn't cleared the bandits out of the area, two Shardbearers would be more than enough to deal with any who remained.
Shardblades can't stop an arrow in the back, Moash thought, feeling exposed. And neither can plate, if we're not wearing it.
His armor and that of Graves lay bundled in their wagon.
Look, that is the triplets, Graves said, waving toward a rock formation. It's right here on the map. We go west now.
I've been this way before, Febreth said. We must continue south, you see. Then east.
The map!
I have no need for your maps, Febreth said, folding his arms. The passions guide me.
The passions? Graves said, throwing his hands up. The passions? You're supposed to have abandoned such superstitions. You belong to the diagram now.
I can do both, Febreth said solemnly.
Moash stuffed another spoonful of stew into his mouth. Storms, he hated it when Febreth took a turn cooking, and when Graves took a turn, and when Fia took a turn, and, well, the stuff Moash himself cooked tasted like spiced dishwater. None of them could cook worth a dun chip. Not like rock. Moash dropped his bowl, letting the mush slop over the side. He grabbed his coat off a tree branch and stalked out into the night. The cold air felt strange on his skin after so long in front of the fire. He hated how cold it was down here. Perpetual winter. The four of them had suffered through the storms, hiding in the cramped, reinforced bottom of their wagon, which they'd chained to the ground. They'd frightened away rogue parchmen with their shard blades. They hadn't been nearly as dangerous as he'd worried. But that new storm... Moash kicked at a rock, but it was frozen to the ground, and he just stubbed his toe. He cursed, then glanced over his shoulder as the argument ended in shouts. He'd once admired how refined Graves seemed. That had been before spending weeks crossing a barren landscape together. The man's patience had frayed to threads, and his refinement didn't matter much when they were all eating slop and pissing behind hills.
So how lost are we? Moash asked as Graves joined him in the darkness outside camp.
Not lost at all, Graves said. If that idiot would actually look at a map.
He glanced at Moash.
I've told you to get rid of that coat.
Which I'll do, Moash said, when we're not crawling across winter's own frozen backside.
At least take the patch off. It might give us away if we meet someone from the war camps. Rip it off!
Graves turned on his heel and walked back toward camp. Moash felt to the Bridge 4 patch on his shoulder. It brought memories. Joining Graves and his band who had been planning to kill King Elokar, an assassination attempt once Dalinar was away, marching toward the center of the Shattered Plains, facing off against Kaladin, wounded and bleeding.
You will not have him.
Moash's skin had gone clammy from the cold. He slid his knife from his side sheath. He still wasn't used to being able to carry one that long. A knife that was too big could get you into trouble as a Dark Eyes. He wasn't Dark Eyed anymore. He was one of them. Storms, he was one of them. He cut the stitches on the Bridge 4 patch. Up one side, then down the other. How simple it was. It would be harder to remove the tattoo he'd gotten with the others, but that he'd had placed on his shoulder, not his forehead. Moash held up the patch, trying to catch the firelight for a last look, and then couldn't bring himself to throw it away. He walked back and settled by the fire. Were the others sitting around Rock's stew pot somewhere? Laughing, joking, betting on how many mugs of ale Lopin could drink, ribbing Kaladin, trying to get him to crack a smile. Moash could almost hear their voices, and he smiled, imagining that he was there. Then he imagined Kaladin telling them what Moash had done.
"He tried to kill me," Kaladin would say. "He betrayed everything. His oath to protect the king, his duty to Alethkar, but most importantly, us."
Moash sagged, patch in his fingers. He should throw the thing in the fire. Storms. He should throw himself in the fire. He looked up toward the skies, toward both Damnation and the Tranquiline Halls. A group of starspren quivered above. And beside them, something moving in the sky? Moash shouted, throwing himself backward off his perch as four Voidbringers descended upon the little camp. They smashed into the ground, wielding long, sinuous swords, not shard blades. Those were Parshendi weapons. One creature struck where Moash had been sitting an instant before. Another creature stabbed Graves straight through the chest, then yanked the weapon free and beheaded him with a backhand swipe. Graves' corpse tumbled, and his shard blade materialized, clanging to the ground. Febreth and Fia didn't have a chance. Other Voidbringers struck them down, spilling their blood in this cold, forgotten land. The fourth Voidbringer came for Moash, who threw himself into a roll. The creature's sword slammed down near him, hitting rock, the blade throwing sparks. Moash rolled to his feet, and Kaladin's training, drilled into him through hours and hours spent at the bottom of a chasm, took over. He danced away, putting his back to the wagon, as his shard blade fell into his fingers. The Voidbringer rounded the fire toward him, light glittering from her taut, muscular body. These weren't like the Parshendi he'd seen on the Shattered Plains. They had deep red eyes and red-violet carapace, some of which framed their faces. The one facing him had a swirling pattern to her skin, three different colors mixing, red, black, white. Dark light, like inverse stormlight, clung to each of them. Graves had spoken of these creatures, calling their return merely one of the events predicted by the inscrutable diagram. Moash's foe came for him, and he lashed out with his blade, driving her back. She seemed to glide as she moved, feet barely touching the ground. The other three ignored him, instead picking through the camp, inspecting the bodies. One soared in a graceful leap onto the wagon and began digging in the items there. His opponent tried again, carefully sweeping her long curved sword at him. Moash shied back, shard blade gripped with both hands, trying to intercept her weapon. His motions seemed clumsy compared to the graceful power of this creature. She slipped to the side, clothing rippling in the wind, breath visible in the cold air. She wasn't taking chances against a shard blade and didn't strike as Moash stumbled. Storms, this weapon was just too clunky. 6 feet long, it was hard to angle right. Yes, it could cut through anything, but he needed to actually hit for that to matter. It had been much easier to wield the thing wearing plate. Without it, he felt like a child holding an adult's weapon. The Voidbringer smiled. Then she struck with blurring speed. Moash stepped back, swinging, forcing her to twist to the side. He took a long cut up the arm, but his move prevented her from impaling him. His arm flared with pain, and he grunted. The Voidbringer regarded him confidently, knowingly. He was dead. Maybe he should simply let it happen. The Voidbringer working in the cart said something eager, excited. He'd found the shard plate. He kicked other items while digging it free, and something rolled out the back of the wagon, thumping against the stone. A spear. Moash looked down at his shard blade, the wealth of nations, the most valuable possession a man could own. "Who am I kidding?" he thought. "Who did I ever think I was kidding?" The Voidbringer woman launched into an attack, but Moash dismissed his shard blade and dashed away. His attacker was so surprised that she hesitated, and Moash had time to dive for the spear, rolling to his feet. Holding the smooth wood in his hand, a familiar weight, Moash snapped easily into his stance. The air suddenly smelled damp and faintly rotten. He remembered the chasms. Life and death together, vines and rot. He could almost hear Kaladin's voice. "You can't fear a shard blade. You can't fear a light eyes on horseback. They kill with fear first and the sword second. Stand your ground." The Voidbringer came for him, and Moash stood his ground. He turned her aside by catching her weapon on the haft of the spear. Then he thrust the butt end of the spear up underneath her arm as she came in for a backhand. The Voidbringer gasped in surprise as Moash executed a takedown he'd practiced 1,000 times in the chasms. He swung the butt of his spear at her ankles and swept her legs out from under her. He began to follow with a classic twist and thrust to stab down through her chest. Unfortunately, the Voidbringer didn't fall. She caught herself in the air, hovering instead of collapsing. Moash noticed in time and pulled out of his maneuver to block her next attack. The Voidbringer glided backward, then dropped to the ground in a prowling crouch, sword held to the side. She then leaped forward and grabbed Moash's spear as he tried to use it to ward her off. Storms! She gracefully pulled herself close to him, inside his reach. She smelled of wet clothing and of the alien, moldy scent he associated with the Parshendi. She pressed her hand against Moash's chest, and that dark light transferred from her to him. Moash felt himself grow lighter. Fortunately, Kaladin had tried this on him too. Moash seized the Voidbringer with one hand, holding onto the front of her loose shirt as his body tried to fall into the air. His sudden pull jerked her off balance, even lifted her a few inches. He yanked her up toward him with one hand, while pushing his spearhead down against the rocky ground. That sent the two of them spinning in the air, hovering. She cried out in an alien tongue. Moash dropped his spear and grabbed his knife. She tried to shove him away, lashing him again, stronger this time. He grunted but hung on and got his knife up and rammed it into her chest. Orange Parshendi blood poured around his hand, spraying into the cold night as they continued to spin in the air. Moash hung on tight and pushed the knife farther. She didn't heal as Kaladin would have. Her eyes stopped glowing and the dark light vanished.
The body grew limp.
A short time later, the force pulling Moash upward ran out. He dropped the 5 feet to the ground, her body cushioning his fall. Orange blood coated him, steaming in the chill air. He seized his spear again, fingers slick with blood, and pointed it at the three remaining Voidbringers who regarded him with stunned expressions.
"Bridge four, you bastards," Moash growled.
Two of the Voidbringers turned toward the third, the other woman, who looked Moash up and down.
"You can probably kill me," Moash said, wiping a hand on his clothes to improve his grip. "But I'll take one of you with me. At least one."
They didn't seem angry that he'd killed their friend. Storms, though, did things like these even have emotions? Shenad often just sat around staring. He locked eyes with the woman at the center. Her skin was white and red, not a bit of black in it. The paleness of that white reminded him of the Shin, who always looked sickly to Moash.
"You," she said in accented Alethi, "have passion."
One of the others handed her Graves's shard blade. She held it up, inspecting it by the firelight. Then she rose into the air.
"You may choose," she said to him. "Die here, or accept defeat and give up your weapons."
Moash clung to the spear in the shadow of that figure, her clothing rippling in the air. Did they think he'd actually trust them? But then, did he really think he could stand against three of them? With a shrug, he tossed aside the spear. He summoned his blade. After all those years dreaming of one of these, he'd finally received one. Kaladin had given it to him. And what good had come of it? He obviously couldn't be trusted with such a weapon. Setting his jaw, Moash pressed his hand to the gemstone and willed the bond to break. The gemstone at its pommel flashed, and he felt an icy coolness wash through him. Back to being a Dark Eyes. He tossed the blade to the ground. One of the Voidbringers took it. Another flew off, and Moash was confused as to what was happening. A short time later, that one returned with 6 more. 3 attached ropes to the shardplate bundles, then flew off, hauling the heavy armor into the air after them. Why not lash it? Moash thought for a moment they were actually going to leave him there. But finally 2 others grabbed him, 1 arm each, and hauled him into the air.
44. The Bright Side. We are indeed intrigued, for we thought it well hidden, insignificant among our many realms. Vale lounged in a tavern tent with her men. Her boots up on a table, chair tipped back, she listened to the life bubbling around her. People drinking and chatting, others strolling the path outside, shouting and joking. She enjoyed the warm, enveloping buzz of fellow humans who had turned this tomb of rock into something alive again. It still daunted her to contemplate the size of the tower. How had anyone built a place this big? It could gobble up most cities Vale had seen without having to loosen its belt. Well, best not to think about that. You needed to sneak low beneath all the questions that distracted scribes and scholars. That was the only way to get anything useful done. Instead, she focused on the people. Their voices blended together, and collectively they became a faceless crowd. But the grand thing about people was that you could also choose to focus on particular faces, really see them, and find a wealth of stories. So many people with so many lives, each a separate little mystery. Infinite detail, like pattern. Look close at his fractal lines, and you'd realize each little ridge had an entire architecture of its own. Look close at a given person, and you'd see their uniqueness. See that they didn't quite match whatever broad category you'd first put them in. So, Red said, talking to Ishna. Vale had brought three of her men today with the spy woman to train them. So Vale could listen, learn, and try to judge if this woman was trustworthy, or if she was some kind of plant. This is great, Red continued. But when do we learn the stuff with the knives? Not that I'm eager to kill anyone, just, you know. I know what? Ishna asked. Knives are devi, Red said. Devi? Vale asked, opening her eyes. Red nodded. Devi, you know, incredible or neat, but in a smooth way. Everyone knows that knives are devi, Gaz added. Ishna rolled her eyes. The short woman wore her hava with hand covered, and her dress had a light touch of embroidery. Her poise and dress indicated she was a dark-eyed woman of relatively high social standing. Vale drew more attention, and not just because of her white jacket and hat. It was the attention of men assessing whether they wanted to approach her, which they didn't do with Ishna. The way she carried herself, the prim hava, kept them back. Vale sipped her drink, enjoying the wine. You've heard lurid stories, I'm sure, Ishna said. But espionage is not about knives in alleys. I'd barely know what to do with myself if I had to stab someone. The three men deflated. Espionage, Ishna continued, is about the careful gathering of information. Your task is to observe, but not to be observed. You must be likable enough that people talk to you, but not so interesting that they remember you.
Well, Gaz is out, Red said.
Yeah, Gaz said. It's a curse to be so storming interesting.
Would you two shut up? Vatha said.
The lanky soldier had leaned in, cup of cheap wine left untouched.
How? He asked. I'm tall. Gaz has one eye. We'll be remembered.
You need to learn to channel attention towards superficial traits you can change, and away from traits you cannot. Red, if you wore an eye patch, that detail would stick in their minds. Vathai can teach you how to slouch, so your height isn't noticeable. And if you add an unusual accent, people will describe you by that. Gaz, I could put you in a tavern and have you lie on the table in a feigned drunken stupor. Nobody will notice the eye patch. They'll ignore you as a drunkard. That is beside the point. We must begin with observation. If you are to be useful, you need to be able to make quick assessments of a location, memorize details, and be able to report back. Now, close your eyes. They reluctantly did so, Vale joining them. Now, Ishna said. Can any of you describe the tavern's occupants, without looking, mind you? Gaz scratched at his eye patch.
There's a cute one at the bar. She might be Thalen.
What color is her blouse?
Hmm. Well, it's low cut, and she's grown some nice rock buds. There's this really ugly guy with an eye patch, Red said. Short, annoying type. Drinks your wine when you aren't looking. Vatha? Ishna asked. What about you?
I think there were some guys at the bar, he said. They were in Sabareal uniforms?
And maybe half the tables were occupied. I couldn't say by who. Better, Ishna said. I didn't expect you to be able to do this. It's human nature to ignore these things. I'll train you, though, so that...
Wait, Vatha said. What about Vale? What does she remember?
3 men at the bar, Vale said absently. Older man with whitening hair and 2 soldiers, probably related, judging by those hooked noses. The younger one is drinking wine. The older one is trying to pick up the woman Gaz noticed. She's not Thalen, but she's wearing Thalen dress with a deep violet blouse and a forest green skirt. I don't like the pairing, but she seems to. She's confident, used to playing with the attention of men. But I think she came here looking for someone because she's ignoring the soldier and keeps glancing over her shoulder. The barkeep is an older man, short enough that he stands on boxes when he fills orders. I bet he hasn't been a barkeep long. He hesitates when someone orders and he has to glance over the bottles, reading their glyphs before he finds the right one. There are 3 barmaids, one is on break, and 14 customers, other than us. She opened her eyes. I can tell you about them.
Won't be necessary, Ishna said as Red clapped softly. Very impressive, Vale. Though I should note that there are 15 other customers, not 14.
Vale started, then glanced around the tent room again, counting, as she'd done in her head just a moment ago. 3 at that table, 4 over there, 2 women standing together by the door, and a woman she'd missed, nestled into a chair by a small table at the back of the tent. She wore simple clothing, a skirt and blouse of Alethi peasant design. Had she intentionally chosen clothing that blended in with the white of the tent and brown of the tables? And what was she doing there? Taking notes, Vale thought with a spike of alarm. The woman had carefully hidden a little notebook in her lap. Who is she? Vale hunkered down. Why is she watching us?
Not us, specifically, Ishna said. There will be dozens like her in the market, moving like rats, gathering what information they can. She might be independent, selling tidbits she finds, but likely she's employed by one of the high princes. That's the job I used to do. I'd guess from the people she's watching that she's been told to gather a report on the mood of the troops.
Vale nodded and listened intently as Ishna started training the men in memory tricks. She suggested they should learn glyphs and use some ploy, like making marks on their hands, to help them keep track of information. Vale had heard of some of these tricks, including the one Ishna talked about, the so-called Mind Museum. Most interesting were Ishna's tips on how to tell what was relevant to report and how to find it. She talked about listening for the names of high princes and for common words used as stand-ins for more important matters, and about how to listen for someone who had just the right amount of drink in them to say things they shouldn't. Tone, she said, was key. You could sit 5 feet from someone sharing important secrets, but miss it because you were focused on the argument at the next table over. The state she described was almost meditative, sitting and letting your ears take in everything, your mind latching on to only certain conversations. Vale found it fascinating. But after about an hour of training, Gaz complained that his head felt like he'd had 4 bottles already. Red was nodding, and the way his eyes were crossed made him seem completely overwhelmed. Vatha, though... He'd closed his eyes and was reeling off descriptions of everyone in the room to Ishna. Vale grinned. For as long as she'd known the man, he'd gone about each of his duties as if he had a boulder tied to his back, slow to move, quick to find a place to sit down and rest. Seeing this enthusiasm from him was encouraging.
In fact, Vale was so engaged, she completely missed how much time had passed. When she heard the market bells, she cursed softly.
I'm a storming fool.
Vale?
Vatha asked.
I've got to get going, she said. Shallan has an appointment.
Who would have thought that bearing an ancient divine mantle of power and honor would involve so many meetings?
And she can't make it without you,
Vatha said.
Storms, have you watched that girl?
She'd forget her feet if they weren't stuck on. Keep practicing. I'll meet up with you later. She pulled on her hat and went dashing through the breakaway. A short time later, Shallan Davar, now safely tucked back into a blue hava, strolled through the hallway beneath Urithiru. She was pleased with the work that Vale was doing with the men, but storms, did she have to drink so much? Shallan burned off practically an entire barrel's worth of alcohol to clear her head. She took a deep breath, then stepped into the former library room. Here she found not only Navani, Yasna, and Teshev, but a host of ardents and scribes. May Aladar, Adratagia from Carbranth. There were even three storm wardens, the odd men with the long beards who liked to predict the weather. Shallan had heard that they would occasionally use the blowing of the winds to foretell the future, but they never offered such services openly. Being near them made Shallan wish for a glyph ward. Vale didn't keep any handy, unfortunately. She was basically a heretic, and thought about religion as often as she did sea silk prices in Ral El Arim. At least Yasna had the backbone to pick a side and announce it. Vale would simply shrug and make some wisecrack. It pattern whispered from her skirt. Shallan? Right. She'd been just standing in the doorway, hadn't she? She walked in, unfortunately passing Yanila, who was acting as Teshev's assistant. The pretty young woman stood with her nose perpetually in the air, and was the type of person whose very enunciation made Shallan's skin crawl. The woman's arrogance was what Shallan didn't like. Not, of course, that Adolin had been courting Yanila soon before meeting Shallan. She had once tried to avoid Adolin's former romantic partners, but, well, that was like trying to avoid soldiers on a battlefield. They were just kind of everywhere. A dozen conversations buzzed through the room. Talk about weights and measures, the proper placement of punctuation, and the atmosphere variations in the tower. Once she'd have given anything to be in a room like this. Now she was constantly late to the meetings. What had changed? I know how much a fraud I am, she thought, hugging the wall, passing a pretty young ardent discussing Azish politics with one of the storm wardens. Shallan had barely perused those books that Adolin had brought her. On her other side, Navani was talking fabrials with an engineer in a bright red hava. The woman nodded eagerly. Yes, but how to stabilize it, Brightness? With the sails underneath, it will want to spin over, won't it? Shallan's proximity to Navani had offered ample opportunity to study fabrial science. Why hadn't she? As it enveloped her, the ideas, the questions, the logic, she suddenly felt she was drowning, overwhelmed. Everyone in this room knew so much, and she felt insignificant compared to them. I need someone who can handle this, she thought. A scholar. Part of me can become a scholar. Not Vale or Brightness Radiant, but someone... Pattern started humming on her dress again. Shallan backed to the wall. No, this was her, wasn't it? Shallan had always wanted to be a scholar, hadn't she? She didn't need another persona to deal with this, right? Right? The moment of anxiety passed, and she breathed out, forcing herself to steady. Eventually, she pulled a pad of paper and a charcoal pencil out of her satchel, then sought out Yasna and presented herself. Yasna cocked an eyebrow. Late again? Sorry. I intended to ask your help understanding some of the translations we're receiving from the Dawn Chant, but we haven't time before my mother's meeting starts. Maybe I could help you. I have a few items to finish up. We can speak later. An abrupt dismissal, but nothing more than Shallan had come to expect. She walked over to a chair beside the wall and sat down. "Surely," she said softly, "if Yasna had known that I'd just confronted a deep insecurity of mine, she'd have shown some empathy, right?" "Yasna?" Pattern asked. "I do not think you are paying attention, Shallan. She is not very empathetic." Shallan sighed. "You're empathetic, though. The pathetic part, at least." She steeled herself. "I belong here, Pattern, don't I?"
Yes, of course you do. You'll want to sketch them, right?"
"The classic scholars didn't just draw. The Oil Sworn knew mathematics. He created the study of ratios in art. Galid was an inventor, and her designs are still used in astronomy today. Sailors couldn't find longitude at sea until the arrival of her clocks. Yasna's a historian, and more. That's what I want."
"Are you sure?"
"I think so."
"Problem was, Vale wanted to spend her days drinking and laughing with the men, practicing espionage. Radiant wanted to practice with the sword and spend time around Adolin. What did Shallan want, and did it matter?"
Eventually, Navani called the meeting to order and people took seats. Scribes on one side of Navani, ardents from a variety of devotaries on the other, and far from Yasna. As the storm wardens settled down farther around the ring of seats, Shallan noticed Renarin standing in the doorway. He shuffled, peeking in, but not entering. When several scholars turned toward him, he stepped backward, as if their stares were physically forcing him out.
"I..." Renarin said. "Father said I could come. Just listen, maybe."
"You're more than welcome, cousin," Yasna said.
She nodded for Shallan to get him a stool, so she did, and didn't even protest being ordered about. She could be a scholar. She'd be the best little ward ever. Head down, Renarin rounded the ring of scholars, keeping a white-knuckled grip on a chain hung from his pocket. As soon as he sat, he started pulling the chain between the fingers of one hand, then the other. Shallan did her best to take notes and not stray into sketching people instead. Fortunately, the proceedings were more interesting than usual. Navani had most of the scholars here working on trying to understand Urithiru. Inadara reported first. She was a wizened scribe who reminded Shallan of her father's ardents, explaining that her team had been trying to ascertain the meaning of the strange shapes of the rooms and tunnels in the tower. She went on at length, talking of defensive constructions, air filtration, and the wells. She pointed out groupings of rooms that were shaped oddly, and of the bizarre murals they'd found, depicting fanciful creatures. When she eventually finished, Calamy reported on her team, who were convinced that certain gold and copper metalworks they'd found embedded in walls were fabrials, but they didn't seem to do anything, even with gems attached. She passed around drawings, then moved on to explaining the efforts, failed so far, they'd taken to try to infuse the gemstone pillar. The only working fabrials were the lifts.
"I suggest,"
interrupted Elthabar, head of the storm wardens,
"that the ratio of the gears used in the lift machinery might be indicative of the nature of those who built it. It is the science of digitology, you see. You can judge much about a man by the width of his fingers."
"And this has to do with gears?"
"How?"
Tashav asked.
"In every way," Elthabar said. "Why, the fact that you don't know this is a clear indication that you are a scribe. Your writing is pretty, Brightness, but you must give more heed to science."
Pattern buzzed softly. "I never have liked him," Shallan whispered.
He acts nice around Dalinar, but he's quite mean.
So, which attribute of his are we totaling, and how many people are in the sample size?
Pattern asked.
Do you think, maybe, Yanala said, we are asking the wrong questions?
Shallan narrowed her eyes, but checked herself, suppressing her jealousy. There was no need to hate someone simply because they'd been close to Adolin.
It was just that something felt off about Yanala.
Like many women at court, her laughter sounded rehearsed, contained, like they used it as a seasoning rather than actually feeling it.
What do you mean, child? Adratagia asked Yanala.
Well, brightness, we talk about the lifts, the strange fabrial column, the twisting hallways. We try to understand these things merely from their designs. Maybe instead we should figure out the tower's needs and then work backward to determine how these things might have met them.
Hmm, Navani said. Well, we know that they grew crops outside. Did some of these wall fabrials provide heat?
Renarin mumbled something. Everyone in the room looked at him. Not a few seemed surprised to hear him speak, and he shrank back.
What was that, Renarin?
Navani asked.
It's not like that, he said softly. They're not fabrials. They're a fabrial.
The scribes and scholars shared looks. The prince, well, he often incited such reactions. Discomforted stares.
Bright Lord? Yanala asked. Are you perhaps secretly an artifabrian? Studying engineering by night? Reading the women's script?
Several of the others chuckled. Renarin blushed deeply, lowering his eyes farther.
You'd never laugh like that at any other man of his rank, Shallan thought, feeling her cheeks grow hot. The Alethi court could be severely polite, but that didn't mean they were nice.
Renarin always had been a more acceptable target than Dalinar or Adolin. Shallan's anger was a strange sensation. On more than one occasion she'd been struck by Renarin's oddness. His presence at this meeting was just another example. Was he thinking of finally joining the Ardents? And he did that by simply showing up at a meeting for scribes? As if he were one of the women? At the same time, how dare Yanala embarrass him?
Navani started to say something, but Shallan cut in.
Surely, Yanala, you didn't just try to insult the son of the High Prince.
What?
No, of course I didn't. Good, Shallan said. Because if you had been trying to insult him, you did a terrible job. And I've heard that you're very clever. So full of wit and charm and other things.
Yanala frowned at her.
Is that flattery?
We weren't talking of your chest, dear. We're speaking of your mind. Your wonderful, brilliant mind. So keen that it's never been sharpened. So quick it's still running when everyone else is done. So dazzling it's never failed to leave everyone in awe at the things you say. So,
Yasna was glaring at her. Shallan held up her notebook.
I took notes.
Could we have a short break, Mother? Yasna asked.
An excellent suggestion, Navani said. 15 minutes, during which everyone should consider a list of requirements this tower would have, if it were to somehow become self-sufficient.
She rose, and the meeting broke up into individual conversations again.
I see, Yasna said to Shallan, that you still use your tongue like a bludgeon rather than a knife.
Yeah, Shallan sighed. Any tips?
Yasna eyed her.
You heard what she said to Renarin, Brightness?
And Mother was about to speak to her about it, Yasna said. Discreetly, with a judicious word.
Instead, you threw a dictionary at her head. Sorry. She gets on my nerves. Yanela is a fool. Just bright enough to be proud of the wits she has, but stupid enough to be unaware of how outmatched they are. Yasna rubbed her temples. Storms. This is why I never take wards. Because they give you so much trouble. Because I'm bad at it. I have scientific evidence of that fact, and you are but the latest experiment. Yasna shooed her away, rubbing her temples. Shallan, feeling ashamed, walked to the side of the room while everyone else got refreshments. Pattern said as Shallan leaned against the wall, notebook held closer to her chest. Yasna doesn't seem angry. Why are you sad? Because I'm an idiot, Shallan said, and a fool, and because I don't know what I want. Hadn't it been only a week or two ago that she'd innocently assumed she had it figured out? Whatever it was?
I can see him, said a voice to her side.
Shallan jumped and turned to find Renarin staring at her skirt and the pattern there, which blended into her embroidery. Distinct if you knew to look, but easy to miss.
He doesn't turn invisible?
Renarin said. He says he can't. Renarin nodded, then looked up at her.
Thank you. For? Defending my honor. When Adolin does that, someone usually gets stabbed. Your way was pleasanter.
Well, nobody should take that tone with you. They wouldn't dare do it to Adolin. And besides, you're right. This place is one big fabril.
You feel it too?
They keep talking about this device or that device, but that's wrong, isn't it? That's like taking the parts of a cart without realizing you've got a cart in the first place. Shallan leaned in. That thing we fought, Renarin. It could stretch its tendrils all the way up to the very top of Urethiru. I felt its wrongness wherever I went. That gemstone at the center is tied to everything.
Yes, this isn't only a collection of fabrials. It's many fabrials put together to make one big fabrial.
But what does it do? Shallan asked.
It does being a city.
He frowned.
Well, I mean, it bees a city. It does what the city is.
Shallan shivered. And the Unmade was running it.
Which let us discover this room and the fabrial column, Renarin said. We might not have accomplished that without it. Always look on the bright side.
Logically, Shallan said, the bright side is the only side you can look on because the other side is dark.
Renarin laughed.
It brought to mind how her brothers would laugh at what she said. Maybe not because it was the most hilarious thing ever spoken, but because it was good to laugh. That reminded her of what Yasna had said, though, and Shallan found herself glancing at the woman.
I know my cousin is intimidating, Renarin whispered to her. But you're a Radiant too, Shallan. Don't forget that. We could stand up to her if we wanted to.
Do we want to? Renarin grimaced.
Probably not. So often she's right, and you just end up feeling like one of the 10 fools.
True, but I don't know if I can stand being ordered around like a child again. I'm starting to feel crazy. What do I do?
Renarin shrugged. I found the best way to avoid doing what Yasna says is to not be around when she's looking for someone to give orders to.
Shallan perked up. That made a lot of sense. Dalinar would need his radiance to go do things, right? She needed to get away, just until she could figure things out. Go somewhere. Like on that mission to Kolinar? Wouldn't they need someone who could sneak into the palace and activate the device?
Renarin, she said, you're a genius.
He blushed, but smiled. Navani called the meeting together again, and they sat to continue discussing fabrials. Yasna tapped Shallan's notebook, and she did a better job of taking the minutes, practicing her shorthand. It wasn't nearly as irksome now as she had an exit strategy, an escape route. She was appreciating that when she noticed a tall figure striding through the door. Dalinar Kolin cast a shadow, even when he wasn't standing in front of the light. Everyone immediately hushed.
Apologies for my tardiness.
He glanced at his wrist and the forearm timepiece that Navani had given him.
Please don't stop because of me.
Dalinar? Navani asked. You've never attended a meeting of scribes before.
I just thought I should watch, Dalinar said. Learn what this piece of my organization is doing.
He settled down on a stool outside the ring. He looked like a warhorse trying to perch on a stand meant for a show pony. They started up again, everyone obviously self-conscious. She'd have thought that Dalinar would know to stay away from meetings like this, where women and scribes... Shallan cocked her head as she saw Renarin glance at his father. Dalinar responded with a raised fist. He came so Renarin wouldn't feel awkward, Shallan realized. It can't be improper or feminine for the prince to be here if the storming Blackthorn decides to attend. She didn't miss the way that Renarin actually raised his eyes to watch the rest of the proceedings.
45. A revelation. As the waves of the sea must continue to surge, so must our will continue resolute. Alone. The Voidbringers carried Moash to Revelar, a city in central Alethkar. Once there, they dropped him outside the city and shoved him toward a group of lesser parchmen. His arms ached from being carried. Why hadn't they used their powers to lash him upward and make him lighter as Kaladin would have? He stretched his arms, looking around. He'd been to Revelar many times, working a regular caravan to Kolinar. Unfortunately, that didn't mean he'd seen much of the city. Every city of size had a little huddle of buildings on the outskirts for people like him. Modern-day nomads who worked caravans or ran deliveries. The people of the Eaves, some had called them. Men and women who hovered close enough to civilization to get out of the weather when it turned bad, but who never really belonged. From the looks of things, Revelar had quite the Eaves culture now. Too much of one. The Voidbringers seemed to have taken over the entire storming place, exiling the humans to the outskirts. The Voidbringers left him without a word, despite having lugged him all this distance. The parchmen who took custody of him here looked like a hybrid between Parshendi warriors and the normal docile parchmen he'd known from many a caravan run. They spoke perfect Alethi as they shoved him toward a group of humans in a little pen. Moash settled in to wait. Looked like the Voidbringers had patrols scouting the area, grabbing human stragglers. Eventually, the parchmen herded him and the others toward one of the large storm bunkers outside the city, used for housing armies or multiple caravans during high storms.
"Don't make trouble," a Parsh woman said, specifically eyeing Moash. "Don't fight or you'll be killed. Don't run or you'll be beaten. You're the slaves now."
Several of the humans, homesteaders from the looks of it, started weeping. They clutched meager bundles, which parchmen searched through. Moash could read the signs of their loss in their reddened eyes and ragged possessions. The Everstorm had wiped out their farm. They'd come to the big city looking for refuge. He had nothing on him of value, not any longer, and the parchmen let him go in before the others. He walked into the bunker, feeling a surreal sense of abandonment. He'd spent the trip here, alternately assuming he'd be executed or interrogated. Instead, they'd made a common slave of him? Even in Sadius's army, he'd never technically been a slave. Assigned to bridge runs, yes. Sent to die. But he'd never worn the brands on his forehead. He felt at the Bridge Four tattoo under his shirt on his left shoulder. The vast high-ceilinged storm bunker was shaped like a huge stone loaf. Moash ambled through it, hands stuffed in his coat pockets. Huddled groups of people regarded him with hostility, even though he was just another refugee. He'd always been met with hostility, no matter where his storming went. A youth like him, too big and obviously too confident for a dark eyes, had been considered a threat. He'd joined the caravans to give himself something productive to do, encouraged by his grandparents. They'd been murdered for their kindly ways, and Moash, he'd spent his life putting up with looks like that. A man on his own, a man you couldn't control, was dangerous. He was inherently frightening, just because of who he was, and nobody would ever let him in. Except Bridge 4. Well, Bridge 4 had been a special case, and he'd failed that test. Graves had been right to tell him to cut the patch off. This was who he really was. The man everyone looked at with distrust, pulling their children tight and nodding for him to move along. He stalked down the middle of the structure, which was so wide it needed pillars to hold up the ceiling. Those rose like trees, soul-cast right into the rock below. The edges of the building were crowded with people, but the center was kept clear and patrolled by armed parshmen. They'd set up stations with wagons as perches where parshmen were addressing crowds. Moash went over to one.
"In case we missed any," the parshmen shouted, "experienced farmers should report to Brew at the front end of the chamber. He will assign you a plot of land to work. Today we also need workers to carry water in the city, and more to clear debris from the last storm. I can take 20 of each."
Men started calling out their willingness, and Moash frowned, leaning toward a man nearby. "They offer us work? Aren't we slaves?"
"Yeah," the man said. "Slaves who don't eat unless they work. They let us choose what we want to do, though it's not much of a storming choice, one kind of drudgery or another."
With a start, Moash realized that the man had pale green eyes. Yet he still raised his hand and volunteered to carry water, something that had once been parshmen work. Well, that was a sight that couldn't help but brighten a man's day. Moash shoved hands back in pockets and continued through the room, checking each of the three stations where parshmen offered jobs. Something about these parshmen and their perfect alethi unsettled him. The Voidbringers were what he'd expected, with their alien accents and dramatic powers. But the ordinary parshmen, many of them looked like Parshendi now, with those taller builds, seemed almost as bewildered at their reversal in fortune as the humans were. Each of the three stations dealt with a different category of labor. The one at the far end was looking for farmers, women with sewing skill, and cobblers. Food, uniforms, boots. The parshmen were preparing for war. Asking around, Moash learned they'd already grabbed the smiths, fletchers, and armorers, and if you were found hiding skill in any of these three, your whole family would be put on half rations. The middle station was for basic labor, hauling water, cleaning, cooking food. The last station was the most interesting to Moash. This was for hard labor. He lingered here, listening to a parshman ask for volunteers to pull wagons of supplies with the army when it marched. Apparently, there weren't enough chulls to move wagons for what was coming. Nobody raised their hands for this one. It sounded like ghastly work, not to mention the fact that it would mean marching toward battle. "They'll need to press the people into this," Moash thought. "Maybe they can round up some light eyes and make them trudge across the rock like beasts of burden. He'd like to see that." As he left this last station, Moash spotted a group of men with long staffs leaning against the wall. Sturdy boots, water skins and holsters tied to their thighs, and a walking kit sewn into the trousers on the other side. He knew from experience what that would carry. A bowl, spoon, cup, thread, needle, patches, and some flint and tinder. Caravaneers. The long staffs were for slapping chull shells while walking beside them. He'd worn an outfit like that many times, though many of the caravans he'd worked had used parshmen to pull wagons instead of chulls. They were faster. "Hey," he said, strolling over to the caravaneers. "Is Guff still around?"
"Guff?"
one of the caravaneers said. "Old wheelwright, half a reed tall, bad at cussing?" "That's him." "I think he's over there," the young man said, pointing with his staff. "In the tents. But there ain't work, friend. The shellheads are marching, Moash said, thumbing over his shoulder. They'll need caravaneers. Positions are full, another of the men said. There was a fight to see who got those jobs. Everyone else will be pulling wagons. Don't draw too much attention or they'll slap a harness on you, mark my words. They smiled in a friendly way to Moash, and he gave them an old caravaner's salute, close enough to a rude gesture that everyone else mistook it, and strode in the direction they'd pointed. Typical. Caravaneers were a big family and, like a family, prone to squabbling. The tents were really some sections of cloth that had been stretched from the wall to poles driven into buckets of rocks to keep them steady. That made a kind of tunnel along the wall here, and underneath a lot of older people coughed and sniffled. It was dim, with only the occasional chip on an overturned box giving light. He picked out the caravaneers by their accents. He asked after Guff, who was one of the men he'd known back in the day and was allowed to penetrate deeper along the shadowy tent tunnel. Eventually, Moash found old Guff sitting right in the middle of the tunnel, as if to keep people from going farther. He had been sanding a piece of wood, an axle by the looks of it. He squinted as Moash stepped up.
Moash, he said. Really? What storm and storm brought you here?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you, Moash said, squatting down beside the old man.
You were on Jam's caravan, Guff said. Off to the Shattered Plains. Gave you all up for dead. Wouldn't have bet a dun chip on you returning.
A wise enough bet, Moash said. He hunched forward, resting his arms on his knees. In this tunnel, the buzz of people outside seemed a distant thing, though only cloth separated them.
Son, Guff asked, why are you here, boy? What do you want?
I just need to be who I was.
That makes as much sense as the Storm and Stormfather playing the flute, boy. But you wouldn't be the first to go off to those plains and come back not all right. No, you wouldn't. That's the Stormfather's storming own truth, that storming is.
They tried to break me. Damnation, they did break me. But then he made me again. A new man.
Moash paused.
I threw it all away.
Sure. Sure, Guff said.
I always do that, Moash whispered. Why must we always take something precious, Guff, and find ourselves hating it? As if by being pure it reminds us of just how little we deserve it. I held the spear, and I stabbed myself with it.
The spear? Guff asked. Boy, you a storming soldier?
Moash looked at him with a start, then stood up, stretching, showing his patchless uniform coat. Guff squinted in the darkness.
Come with me.
The old wheelwright rose, with difficulty, and set his piece of wood on his chair. He led Moash with a rickety gate farther into the cloth tunnel, and they entered a portion of the tented area that was more room-like, the far corner of the large bunker. Here, a group of maybe a dozen people sat in furtive conversation, chairs pulled together. A man at the door grabbed Guff by the arm as he shuffled in.
Guff, you're supposed to be on guard, fool man. I'm storming on storming guard, you pisser,
Guff said, shaking his arm free.
The Bright wanted to know if we found any soldiers. Well, I found a storming soldier, so storm off.
The guard turned his attention to Moash, then flicked his eyes to Moash's shoulder.
Deserter?
Moash nodded. It was true in more ways than one.
What's this?
One of the men stood up, a tall fellow. Something about his silhouette, that bald head, that cut of clothing.
Deserter, Brightlord,
the guard said.
And the Shattered Plains,
Guff added. The High Lord, Moash realized. Paladar. Bama's kinsman and regent, a notoriously harsh man. In years past, he had nearly run the city to the ground, driving away many dark eyes who had the right of travel. Not a caravan had passed when someone hadn't complained about Paladar's greed and corruption.
From the shattered plains, you say, Paladar said. Excellent. Tell me, deserter, what news is there from the High Princes? Do they know of my plight here? Can I expect aid soon?
They put him in charge, Moash thought, spotting other light eyes. They wore fine clothing, not silks, of course, but well-trimmed uniforms, exceptional boots. There was food aplenty set out at the side of this chamber, while those outside scrounged and did heavy labor. He'd begun to hope, but of course that had been stupid. The arrival of the Voidbringers hadn't cast the light eyes down. The few Moash had seen outside were merely the sacrifices. The fawning dark eyes at the periphery confirmed this. Soldiers, guards, some favored merchants. To damnation with them. They'd been given a chance to escape from the light eyes, and it had only made them more eager to be servants. In that moment, surrounded by the pettiness that was his own kind, Moash had a revelation. He wasn't broken. All of them were broken. A Lethe society, light-eyed and dark. Maybe all of humankind.
Well, the regent demanded, speak up, man.
Moash remained silent, overwhelmed. He wasn't the exception, always ruining what he was given. Men like Kaladin were the exception, the very, very rare exception. These people proved it. There was no reason to obey Light Eyes. They had no power, no authority. Men had taken opportunity and cast it to the creme.
I think there's something wrong with him, Bright Lord, the guard said. Yeah, Guff added. Should maybe have mentioned he's storming strange in the head now, storming pisser.
Bah, the regent said, pointing at Moash. Have that one thrown out. We haven't time for foolishness if we are to restore my place.
He pointed at Guff.
Have that one beaten, and post a competent guard next time, kid, or you'll be next.
Old Guff cried out as they seized him. Moash just nodded. Yes. Of course. That was what they would do. The guards took him under the arms and dragged him to the side of the tent. They parted the cloth and hauled him out. They passed a frazzled woman trying to divide a single piece of flatbread between three young crying children. You could probably hear their weeping from the Bright Lord's tent, where he had a stack of bread piled high. The guards threw him back out into the street that ran down the middle of the large bunker. They told him to stay away, but Moash barely heard. He picked himself up, dusted himself off, then walked to the third of the workstations, the one seeking hard laborers. There he volunteered for the most difficult job they had, pulling wagons of supplies for the Voidbringer army. 46. When the Dream Dies. Did you expect anything else from us? We need not suffer the interference of another. Race is contained, and we care not for his prison. Scar the Bridgeman ran up one of the ramps outside Urethiru, breath puffing in the cold air as he silently counted his steps to maintain focus. The air was thinner up here at Urethiru, and that made running harder, though he really only noticed it outside. He wore full marching pack and gear. Rations, equipment, helmet, jerkin, and a shield tied to the back. He carried his spear and even had some greaves stuck to his legs, held in place by the shape of the metal. All of that weighed almost as much as he did. He finally hit the top of the Oathgate platform. Storms, but the center building looked farther away than he remembered. He tried to pick up his pace anyway and jogged for all he was worth, the pack clinking. Finally, sweating, breath growing ragged, he reached the control building and dashed inside. He finally pulled to a stop, dropping his spear and resting his hands on his knees, gasping for breath. Most of Bridge 4 waited here, some glowing with stormlight. Of them all, Scar was the only one who, despite 2 weeks of practice, still hadn't figured out how to draw it in. Well, except for Dabbit and Relaine. Sigzel checked the clock they'd been allocated by Navani Kolin, a device the size of a small box.
"That was about 10 minutes," he said. "Just under."
Scar nodded, wiping his brow. He'd run over a mile from the center of the market, then crossed the plateau and charged the ramp. Storms. He'd pushed himself too hard.
"How long," he said, gasping. "How long did it take Drahi?"
The two had set out together. Sigzel glanced at the tall, muscled bridgeman who still glowed with residual stormlight.
"Under 6 minutes."
Scar groaned, sitting down.
"The Bislan is equally important, Scar," Sigzel said, making glyphs in his notebook. "We need to know a normal man's abilities to make comparisons. Don't worry, though. I'm sure you'll figure out Stormlight soon."
Scar flopped backward, looking up. Lopin was walking around on the ceiling of the room, storming Herr Dazian.
"Drahi, you used a quarter of a basic lashing by Kaladin's terminology?"
Sigzel continued, still making notes.
"Yeah," Drahi said. I know the precise amount, Sig. Strange.
Which made you half as heavy as usual when we put you on the scale back in the rooms. But why does a quarter lashing make you half as heavy? Shouldn't it make you 25% as heavy?
Does it matter? Drahi asked.
Sigzel looked at him as if he were crazy.
Of course it does.
I want to try a lashing at an angle next, Drahi said. See if I can make it feel like I'm running downhill, no matter which direction I go. Might not need it. Holding Stormlight, it made me feel like I could run forever.
Well, it's a new record, Sigzel mumbled, still writing. You beat Lopin's time.
Did he beat mine?
Leighton called from the side of the room where he was inspecting the tiling on the floor.
You stopped for food on the way, Leighton, Sigzel said. Even Rock beat your time, and he was skipping like a girl the last third.
Was horny the dance of victory, Rock said from near Leighton. Is very manly.
Manly or not, it threw off my test, Sigzel said. At least Scar is willing to pay attention to proper procedure.
Scar remained lying on the ground as the others chatted. Kaladin was supposed to come and transport them to the shattered plains, and Sigzel had decided to run some tests. Kaladin, as usual, was late. Teft sat down next to Scar, inspecting him with dark green eyes with bags underneath. Kaladin had named the two of them lieutenants, along with Rock and Sigzel, but their roles had never really settled into that ranking. Teft was the perfect definition of a platoon sergeant.
Here, Teft said, handing over a chowta,
meatballs wrapped in flatbread, Herdazian style.
Leighton brought food. Eat something, lad.
Scar forced himself to sit up.
I'm not that much younger than you, Teft. I'm hardly a lad.
Teft nodded to himself, chewing on his own chowder. Finally, Scar started into his. It was good, not spicy like a lot of Alethi food, but still good. Flavorful.
Everyone keeps telling me that I'll get it soon, Scar said. But what if I don't? There won't be room in the Windrunners for our lieutenant who has to walk everywhere. I'll end up cooking lunch with Rock. Ain't nothing wrong with being on the support team. Pardon, Sarge, but storm that. Do you know how long I waited to hold a spear?
Scar picked up the weapon from beside his pack and laid it across his lap.
I'm good at it. I can fight, only...
Lopin left the ceiling, rotating to get his legs under him and floating gently to the floor. He laughed as Bissig, in turn, tried flying up to the ceiling and crashed headfirst into it. Bissig hopped to his feet, looking down at them all, embarrassed. But what did he have to be embarrassed about? He was standing on the ceiling.
You were in the military before, Teft guessed.
No, but not for lack of trying. You heard of the Black Caps?
Aladar's personal guards?
Let's just say they didn't think much of my application.
Yes, we let dark guys in, but not runts.
Teft grunted, chewing on his chowder.
said they might reconsider if I equipped myself, Scar said. Do you know how much armor costs? I was a stupid rock splitter with visions of battlefield glory. It used to be they'd never speak about their pasts. That had changed, though Scar couldn't specify exactly when. It came out as part of the catharsis of having become something greater. Teft was an addict, Drahi had struck an officer, Eth had been caught planning to desert with his brother. Even simple Hobber had been part of a drunken brawl. Knowing Hobber, he'd probably only gone along with what his squad was doing, but a man had ended up dead. You'd think, Teft said, that our high and mighty leader would have gotten here by now. I swear Kaladin acts more like a light eyes every day. Don't let him hear you say that, Scar said. I'll say what I want, Teft snapped. If that boy's not going to come, maybe I should be going. I have things to do. Scar hesitated, glancing up at Teft. Not that, Teft growled. I barely touched the stuff in days. You'd think a man had never had a wild night out the way you're all treating me. Didn't say a thing, Teft. Knowing what we've suffered, it's insane to think that we wouldn't need something to get us through the day. The moss isn't the problem. It's the storming world going all crazy. That's the problem. Sure is, Teft. Teft eyed him, then studied his chowder roll intently. So, how long have the men known? I mean, did anyone... Not long, Scar said quickly. Nobody's even thinking about it. Teft nodded and didn't see through the lie. Truth was, most of them had noticed Teft sneaking off to grind a little moss now and then. It wasn't uncommon in the army. But doing what he'd done, missing duty, selling his uniform, ending up in an alley, that was different. It was the sort of thing that could get you discharged at best. At worst, well, it might get you assigned to bridge duty. Trouble was, they weren't common soldiers anymore. They weren't light eyes, either. They were something strange, something that nobody understood. I don't want to talk about this, Teft said. Look, weren't we discussing how to get you to glow? That's the problem at hand. Before he could press further, Kaladin Stormblessed finally deigned to arrive, bringing with him the scouts and hopefuls from other bridge crews who had been trying to draw in Stormlight. So far, nobody except men from Bridge 4 had managed it, but that included a few that had never actually run bridges. Huio and Punio, Lopin's cousins, and men like Cohen, from the old Cobalt Guard who had been recruited into Bridge 4 a couple months back. So there was still hope that others could manage it. Kaladin had brought roughly 30 people beyond those who had already been training with the team. Judging by their uniform patches, this 30 had come from other divisions, and some were light-eyed. Kaladin had mentioned asking General Kahl to round up the most promising potential recruits from throughout the Alethi army. All here, Kaladin said. Good. He strode to the side of the single-roomed control building, a sack of glowing gemstones slung over his shoulder. His magnificent shard blade appeared in his hand, and he slid it into the keyhole in the chamber wall. Kaladin engaged the ancient mechanism, pushing the sword, and the entire inner wall, which could rotate, toward a specific point marked by murals. The floor began to glow, and outside Stormlight rose in a swirl around the entire stone plateau. Kaladin locked the blade into place at the mark on the floor designated the Shattered Plains. When the glow faded, they'd come to Narak. Sigzil left his pack and armor leaning against the wall and strode out. Best they could determine, the entire stone top of the platform had come with them, swapping places with the one that had been out here. At the platform edge, a group of people climbed across a ramp to meet them. A short Alethi woman named Ristina counted out the bridgemen and soldiers as they passed, marking on her ledger. "Took you long enough, Bright Lord," she noted to Kaladin, whose eyes glowed faintly blue. "The merchants were beginning to complain." "It took Stormlight to power the device,"
Some of the gemstones in Kaladin's sack would have been drained by the process, but curiously, it didn't take much more to swap two groups than it did to travel one way. So they tried to run the oath gates when they had people on both sides wanting to exchange places. "Tell merchants when they next come through," Kaladin said, "that the Knights Radiant are not their doormen. They'll want to accustom themselves to waiting unless they find a way to swear the oaths themselves." Rastina smirked and wrote it down as if she were going to pass on that exact message. Scar smiled at that. Nice to see a scribe with a sense of humor. Kaladin led the way through the city of Narak, once a Parshendi stronghold, now an increasingly important human way stop between the war camps and Urethiru. The buildings here were surprisingly sturdy, well constructed of krem and carved great shell carapace. Scar had always assumed the Parshendi to be like the nomads who roved between Azir and Yakabed. He imagined Parshendi who were wild and ferocious, without civilization, hiding in caves for storms. Yet here was a well-built, carefully laid-out city. They'd found a building full of artwork of a style that baffled the Alethi scribes. Parshman art. They'd been painting even while they fought a war. Just like, well, just like ordinary people. He glanced at Shen, no, Relaine, it was hard to remember, walking with spear to his shoulder. Scar forgot he was there most of the time, and that made him ashamed. Relaine was as much a member of Bridge Four as anyone else, right? Would he rather have been painting than fighting? They passed sentry posts full of Dalinar's soldiers, along with many in red and light blue, Ruthar's colors. Dalinar was putting some of the other soldiers to work, trying to prevent more dust-ups between soldiers from different princedoms. Without the fighting on the shattered plains to keep them focused, the men were getting restless. They passed a large group of soldiers practicing with bridges on a nearby plateau. Scar couldn't hold back a grin as he saw their black uniforms and helms. Plateau runs had been started again, but with more structure, and the spoils were shared equally among the high princes. Today it was the Black Cap's turn. Scar wondered if any of them would recognize him. Probably not, even if he had caused quite a ruckus among them. There had been only one logical way to get the equipment he needed for his application. He'd stolen it from the Black Cap quartermaster. Scar had thought they would praise his ingenuity. He was so eager to be a Black Cap that he'd go to great lengths to join them, right? Wrong. His reward had been a slave brand and eventual sale to Sadius's army. He brushed his fingers across the scars on his forehead. Stormlight had healed the brands of the other men. They'd covered them all up with tattoos anyway. But it seemed another little dig, dividing him from the others. Right now, he was the only fighting man in Bridge Four who still had his slave brand. Well, him and Kaladin, whose scars wouldn't heal for some reason. They reached the training plateau, crossing the old Bridge Four, which was held in place with some soul-cast rock guideposts. Kaladin called a meeting of the officers as several of Rock's children set up a water station. The tall Horn-Eater seemed beyond enthused to have his family working with him. Scar joined Kaladin, Sigzel, Teft, and Rock. Though they stood close, there was a conspicuous gap where Moash should have been. It felt so wrong to have a member of Bridge Four completely unaccounted for, and Kaladin's silence on the topic hung over them like an executioner's axe. "I'm worried," Kaladin said, "that nobody practicing with us has begun breathing stormlight."
"It's only been 2 weeks, sir," Sigzel said.
"True, but Syl thinks several feel right, though she won't tell me who, as she says it would be wrong." Kaladin gestured toward the newcomers. "I asked Kahl to send me another batch of hopefuls because I figured the more people we had, the better our chances of finding new squires." He paused. "I didn't specify they couldn't be light-eyed. Perhaps I should have."
"Don't see why, sir," Scar said, pointing. "That's Captain Kolat. Good man. He helped us explore. Just wouldn't feel right having light-eyed men in Bridge Four."
"Other than you?" Scar asked. "And Renarin? And, well,
any of us who earn our own blades, and maybe Rock, who I think might have been light-eyed among his people, even if he has dark... Fine, Scar, Kaladin said. Point made. Anyway, we don't have a lot of time left before I leave for Elokar. I'd like to push the recruits harder, see if they're likely to be able to swear the oaths. Any thoughts?
Shove them off edge of plateau, Rock said. Those who fly, we let in.
Any serious suggestions? Kaladin asked.
Let me run them through some formations, Teft said.
A good idea, Kaladin said. Storms, I wish we knew how the Radiants used to handle expansion. Were there recruitment drives, or did they just wait until someone attracted a spren?
That wouldn't make them a squire, though, Teft said, rubbing his chin. But a full Radiant, right?
A valid point, Sigsel said. We have no proof that we squires are a step toward becoming full Radiants. We might always be your support team. And in that case, it's not individual skill that matters, but your decision. Maybe that of your spren. You choose them, they serve under you, and then they start drawing in Stormlight.
Yeah, Scar said, uncomfortable. They all glanced at him. The first of you that says something placating, Scar said, gets a fist in the face. Or the stomach if I can't reach your stormin' stupid horn-eater face.
Rock said. You could hit my face, Scar. I have seen you jump very high. Almost you seem as tall as regular person when you do that.
Teft, Kaladin said. Go ahead and run those potential recruits through formations, and tell the rest of the men to watch the sky. I'm worried about more raids in the caravans. He shook his head. Something about those raids doesn't add up. The war camp's parshmen, by all reports, have marched to Alethkar. But why would those fused keep harrying us? They won't have the troops to take advantage of any supply problems they cause. Scar shared a glance with Sigsel, who shrugged. Kaladin talked like this sometimes, differently from the rest of them. He'd trained them in formations in the spear, and they could proudly call themselves soldiers. But they'd only actually fought a few times. What did they know of things like strategy and battlefield tactics? They broke. Teft jogging off to drill the potential recruits. Kaladin set Bridgeford to studying their flying. They practiced landings and then did sprints in the air, zipping back and forth in formation, getting used to changing directions quickly. It was a little distracting, seeing those glowing lines of light shoot through the sky. Scar attended Kaladin as he observed the recruits doing formations. The light eyes didn't voice a single complaint about being filed into ranks with dark eyes. Kaladin and Teft, well, all of them really, had a tendency to act as if every light-eyed man was in some way regal. But there were far, far more of them who did normal jobs, though granted they got paid better for those jobs than a dark-eyed man did. Kaladin watched, then glanced at the bridge foreman in the sky.
I wonder, Scar, he said, how important are formations going to be for us, going forward?
Can we devise new ones to use in flying? Everything changes when your enemy can attack from all sides. After about an hour, Scar went for water and enjoyed some good-natured ribbing from the others who landed to grab something to drink. He didn't mind. What you had to watch out for was when Bridgeford didn't torment you. The others took off a short time later and Scar watched them go, launching into the sky. He took a long draft of Rock's current refreshment. He called it tea, but it tasted like boiled grain, and found himself feeling useless. Were these people, these new recruits, going to start glowing and take his place in Bridge 4? Would he be shuffled off to other duties while someone else laughed with the crew and got ribbed for their height?
Storm it, he thought, tossing aside his cup. I hate feeling sorry for myself.
He hadn't sulked when the black caps had turned him down, and he wouldn't sulk now. He was fishing in his pocket for gemstones, determined to practice some more, when he spotted Lynn sitting on a rock nearby, watching the recruits run formations. She was slouching, and he read frustration in her posture. Well, he knew that feeling. Scar shouldered his spear and sauntered over. The four other scout women had gone to the water station. Rock let out a bellowing laugh at what one of them said.
Not joining in? Scar asked, nodding toward the new recruits marching past.
I don't know formations, Scar. I've never done drills, never even held a storming spear. I ran messages and scouted the planes.
She sighed.
I didn't pick it up fast enough, did I? He's gone and gotten some new people to test since I failed.
Don't be stupid, Scar said, sitting beside her on the large rock. You're not being forced out. Kaladin just wants to have as many potential recruits as possible.
She shook her head. Everyone knows that we're in a new world now, a world where rank and eye color don't matter. Something glorious.
She looked up at the sky and the men training there.
I want to be part of it, Scar. So badly.
Yeah. She looked at him, probably saw it in his eyes, that same emotion.
Storms. I hadn't even thought, Scar. Must be worse for you.
He shrugged and reached into his pouch, taking out an emerald as big as his thumb. It shone fiercely, even in the bright daylight.
You ever hear about the first time Captain Stormblessed drew in light?
He told us. That day after he knew he could do it because Tef told him, and
not that day.
You mean while he was healing, she said, after the high storm where he was strung up?
Not that day either, Scar said, holding up the gemstone.
Through it he saw men running formations and imagined them carrying a bridge.
I was there, second row, bridge run, bad one. We were charging the plateau and a lot of Parshendi had set up. They dropped most of the first row, all but Kaladin. That exposed me, right beside him, second row. In those days you didn't have good odds running near the front. The Parshendi wanted to take down our bridge and they focused their shots on us, on me. I knew I was dead. I knew it. I saw the arrows coming, and I breathed a last prayer, hoping the next life wouldn't be quite so bad. Then the arrows moved, Lin. They storming swerved toward Kaladin.
He turned the emerald over and shook his head.
There's a special lashing you can do, which makes things curve in the air. Kaladin painted the wood above his hands with stormlight and drew the arrows toward him instead of me. That's the first time I can say I knew something special was happening.
He lowered the gemstone and pressed it into her hand.
Back then, Kaladin did it without even knowing what he was doing. Maybe we're just trying too hard, you know?
But it doesn't make sense. They say you have to suck it in. What does that even mean?
No idea, Scar said. They each describe it differently, and it's breaking my brain trying to figure it out. They talk about a sharp intake of breath, only not really for breathing.
Which is perfectly clear.
Tell me about it, Scar said, tapping the gemstone in her palm.
It worked best for Kaladin when he didn't stress. It was harder when he focused on making it happen.
So I'm supposed to accidentally but deliberately breathe something in without breathing, but not try too hard at it?
Doesn't it just make you want to string up the lot of them in the storms?
But their advice is all we got. So...
She looked at the stone, then held it close to her face. That didn't seem to be important, but what could it hurt? And breathed in. Nothing happened. So she tried again, and again, for a solid 10 minutes.
I don't know, Scar, she finally said, lowering the stone. I keep thinking maybe I don't belong here. If you haven't noticed, none of the women have managed this. I kind of forced my way among you all, and nobody asked.
Stop, he said, taking the emerald and holding it before her again.
Stop right there. You want to be a windrunner?
More than anything, she whispered.
Why?
Because I want to soar.
Not good enough.
Kaladin. He wasn't thinking about being left out or how great it would be to fly. He was thinking about saving the rest of us. Saving me.
Why do you want to be in the Windrunners?
Because I want to help. I want to do something other than stand around waiting for the enemy to come to us.
Well, you have a chance, Lin. A chance nobody has had for ages. A chance in millions. Either you seize it,
and in so doing decide you're worthy, or you leave and give up. He pressed the gemstone back down into her hand. But if you leave, you don't get to complain. As long as you keep trying, there's a chance. When you give up, that's when the dream dies. She met his eyes, closed her fist around the gemstone, and breathed in with a sharp, distinct breath. Then started glowing. She yelped in surprise and opened her hand to find the gemstone within done. She looked at him in awe.
What did you do?
Nothing, Scar said, which was the problem. Still, he found he couldn't be jealous. Maybe this was his lot, helping others become radiants. A trainer? A facilitator? Teft saw Lynn glowing, then dashed over and started cursing. But they were good Teft curses. He grabbed her by the arm and towed her toward Kaladin. Scar took in a long, satisfied breath. Well, that was two he'd helped so far, counting Rock. He could live with that, couldn't he? He strolled over to the drink station and got another cup.
What is this foul stuff, Rock? He asked. You didn't mistake the washing water for tea, did you?
His old horn-eater recipe, he said, has proud tradition.
Like skipping?
Like formal war dance, he said, and hitting annoying bridgemen on head for not showing proper respect.
Scar turned around and leaned one hand on the table, watching Lynn's enthusiasm as her squad of scouts ran up to her. He felt good about what he'd done. Strangely good. Excited, even.
I think I'm going to have to get used to smelly horn-eaters, Rock, Scar said. I'm thinking of joining your support team.
You think I will let you anywhere near Cookpot?
I might not ever learn to fly.
He squished the part of him that whimpered at that.
I need to come to terms with the fact, so I'll have to find another way to help out.
Ha! And the fact that you are glowing with stormlight right now is not at all consideration in decision?
Scar froze. Then he focused on his hand, right in front of his face, holding a cup. Tiny wisps of stormlight curled off it. He dropped the cup with a cry, digging from his pocket a couple of dun chips. He'd given his practice gemstone to Lynn. He looked up at Rock, then grinned stupidly.
I suppose, Rock said, I can maybe have you wash dishes, though you do keep throwing my cups on the ground. It's not proper respect at all.
He trailed off as Scar left him, running for the others and whooping with excitement.
47. So much is lost. Indeed, we admire his initiative. Perhaps if you had approached the correct one of us with your plea, it would have found favorable audience.
I am Talanel Elin, herald of war. The time of the return, the desolation is near at hand. We must prepare. You will have forgotten much following the destruction of the times past. Kalak will teach you to cast bronze, if you have forgotten this. We will soul-cast blocks of metal directly for you. I wish we could teach you steel, but casting is so much easier than forging, and you must have something we can produce quickly. Your stone tools will not serve against what is to come. Videl can train your surgeons, and Jezrian will teach you leadership. So much is lost between returns. I will train your soldiers. We should have time. Ishar keeps talking about a way to keep information from being lost following desolations. And you have discovered something unexpected. We will use that. Surge binders to act as guardians. Knights. The coming days will be difficult, but with training, humanity will survive. You must bring me to your leaders. The other heralds should join us soon. I think I am late, this time. I fear, oh God, that I have failed. No, this is not right, is it? How long has it been? Where am I? I am Talanel Elin, herald of war. The time of the return, the desolation is near at hand. Yasna trembled as she read the madman's words. She turned over the sheet,
and found the next one covered in similar ideas, repeated over and over. This couldn't be a coincidence, and the words were too specific. The abandoned herald had come to Kolinar, and had been dismissed as a madman. She leaned back in her seat, and Ivory, full-sized, like a human, stepped over to the table. Hands clasped behind his back, he wore his usual stiff, formal suit. The Spren's coloring was jet black, both clothing and features, though something prismatic swirled on his skin. It was as if pure black marble had been coated in oil that glistened with hidden color. He rubbed his chin, reading the words.